Welcome to True Talk on WMNF 88.5 with Ahmed and Samar. Samar is not on the program this Friday. She'll be back next week. Today is the 14th day of Ramadan. On today's program, we'll be speaking to Bassem Hassan from the United States Census Bureau about the challenges the census is facing during the time of the COVID-19 pandemic, and also specifically the challenge of counting Arab Americans and people of MENA background, that stands for Middle East and North Africa. But speaking of Ramadan, today's the 14th day of Ramadan, half the month is gone. And Ramadan, as you remember, we talked about before, is the month where Muslims fast from eating and drinking all day from before sunrise to sunset for an entire month, 30 days. Ramadan is on a lunar calendar, which means that every year starts about 11 to 12 days earlier than the year before. And during this month of fasting from all food and drink, and also includes fasting from sexual intercourse during daylight hours. But after sunset, Muslims are able to eat and drink, and they can do that until before the sun rises the next morning, or about an hour before the sunrise. So our schedule is flipped upside down. We're not eating during the day, and we're eating at night. Every night we have a break fast right at sunset. That's where actually the word breakfast comes from. It's breaking fast. So we break the fast and we have a meal. We do a lot of prayers. But this year's Ramadan is very unique, like everything else that's unique during this unprecedented time of social distancing and isolation during the COVID-19 pandemic. Muslims are not going to the mosque to do their worship. They're staying at home. So it's a completely different form of Ramadan. If you happen to have any Muslim friends, well, I'm sure, most of you do, or many of you do, or if you don't, find one. You can tell them Ramadan Mubarak. That's a proper greeting. But when we come back, we'll be speaking to Bassem Hassan from the United States Census Bureau. Stay tuned. This is True Talk on WMNF. عيونك حيرة وحكاوي كتيرة متغير يا ما عن زمان قافل على قلبك البيبان حبيت وفرقت كم مكان عايش جواك إحساسك كل يوم يقل وتخطي وخطوتك تزل من كتر ما أحبطوك تمل فين تلقى دواك بتودع حلم كل يوم تستفرد بيك الهموم وكلكم والغرباكم والجرح كبير ما بتديش حاجة اهتمام أهلا أهلا سلام سلام بقى طبعك قلة الكلام وما فيش تفسير وطنك والأهل والصحاب كم واحد ودع وساب من غير أسباب شايف في عينك نظرة حنين بتحن لمين ولا مين طول عمرها ماشية السنين والناس ركاب مع دقة عقرب الساعات بتموت جوانا ذكريات عشمنا قلوبنا باللي فات ونسينا نعيش كان مكتوب نمشي الطريق ونفارق كل ما ده شيء اتسرق العمر بالبطيء ورسي على ما فيش وداري داري يا قلبي مهما بشيء إلا وفراق يشوف Welcome back to True Talk on WMNF 88.5 with Ahmed and Samar. Now we're going to be speaking about something that should be on everyone's mind, even though it may not be the top issue on folks' mind right now, considering that we're under this pandemic of COVID-19. But we're now joined by Bassem Hassan, who is with the U.S. Census, the United States Census. Welcome to True Talk.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Bassem, you're an Arab American. You're a Muslim. You're from New Jersey. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Generally speaking, my background has been in communications. Couple of jobs before this one, I was a communications professor. I work generally with national and international campaigns. Okay. And my strengths have been with motivating people to do things that are generally good for themselves or society. So that's a little different than selling products.
So you're not some evil communications person for, like, you know, some big corporations that want to take money and destroy the world.
Those are my earlier jobs, but not anymore.
Okay. So what's your cultural background? You know, what country are you from originally, or your parents?
I am Egyptian, and according to my parents, my lineage goes right back to the pharaohs.
Okay. So you're a true, you know, Egyptian. Your ancestors built the pyramid.
Yes, exactly. And I was born in Cairo. I came here when I was 2, and I've been raised in the U.S. ever since. So I have a good spectrum of, you know, culture and, you know, ethnicity as being a first-gen immigrant.
Okay, well, I mean, it's, you know, it's a stretch to say first-gen immigrant when you come at 2 years old. I'm not sure how much you actually remember from being there, but during that time, but, you know, like yourself, I'm also an Egyptian-American. It's the first time we actually met over the phone now. But how was it that you retained this type of cultural identity? Or, you know, you said you have a strong, I guess, cultural background. You know, when you come here at 2 years old, how do you, you know, keep that with you or retain it?
Well, so I came when I was 2, but I've been back to Egypt many times. I mean, it was pretty much the, you know, when I was young for the summers, my parents would just send me to Egypt and let my aunts and uncles deal with me. Mm-hmm. So I got a good dose of what is my, you know, this is my ethnicity. Coming here to the U.S., you do have a little bit of that nomadic, you know, it's almost like a diaspora feeling. You know, so it gives you an opportunity to, you know, embrace the best of Western culture. Because you're an outsider, you get to choose what, you know, what you want to embrace. But also do it in a way that, like, you really don't forget your roots. You know, at the end of the day, you know, I'm Egyptian, my kids are Egyptian. You know,
what does that mean, you don't forget your roots? What are your roots? I mean, what is that? And how does that, conflict with being an American?
No, it doesn't. I mean, one of the things that I take pride of in saying, you know, this is a strong element in Egyptian culture is, you know, we're very hospitable people. We're very friendly. When you go to Egypt, you see it everywhere. People don't miss an opportunity to help each other. And that's something that's not as common here in the U.S. People are a little more reserved, you know, so it's like the game that everybody plays when dinner's over, you know, who's paying for dinner.
Yeah. Like in Egypt and in the Arab world, people are fighting to pay the bill. Where here, people are fighting not to pay the bill.
Exactly. And that's what I mean when I say that, you know, these are the elements of my Arab Egyptian culture that I really do take pride in and I want to hold on to. You know, I want it to be something that people recognize as, you know, when they're spending time with me, they can say there's something a little different about him. And if it comes up in conversation, I say, oh, but that's just my culture. You know, it's, right. You know, if you see something you like, I gift it to you. You know, no questions asked. Take it. You know, consider it a gift.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of common where it happens. If you're wearing like a nice watch or a jacket, and then somebody says, that's a nice, whatever watch ring. And they're like, oh, here, take it. And you're, a bit confused. But I remember growing up as an Egyptian American and going back to visit Egypt. Now, growing up, I didn't visit Egypt every summer, like you're saying that you did. But I know many families do that. So it had been a while since I'd gone to Egypt. And sometime in high school, I went back. And I don't know if you felt the same way, but maybe it didn't apply to you because you were going back more frequent. But I felt like I didn't reckon it, because I left Egypt when I was 9 years old. So I kind of remember a little bit of it. I spent some time in school there. Mm-hmm. And then going back, it just seemed like a different world. And for a time, I wasn't sure, am I American? Am I Egyptian? I don't know if you ever experienced that, or you know people that had kind of this questioning their identity. Oh. What's,
That's what I refer to as that nomadic sense. It's almost like an immigrant diaspora, mm-hmm. Where you long for a homeland that is increasingly not familiar to you.
Right.
If you know what I mean. I was raised here, so I can't really 100%, get into the subtleties of what it must be like going through high school in Egypt, and the stories that I hear my parents say about sneaking out and going to the cinema. it gives you an opportunity to create a new hybrid identity.
I guess a hybrid would be an accurate, because some way when you go back to Egypt, other than visiting family, you feel like you don't fully belong there, and people kind of look at you like, oh, well, you're not really Egyptian, you're American. And when you
absolutely
in America, they're like, well, you're not really American,
you're Egyptian.
You're Egyptian. So you're like in between worlds.
And exactly, and hence that weird sensation of being a nomad, where you're constantly, in a place that is not 100% your home. On the positive side, though, it gives you the opportunity to be very selective over what parts of culture you want to embrace, because ultimately you're going to be creating something new. The people who were born, raised until their 30s and 40s in Egypt, they're not wired the way we are. Likewise, my children, for instance, they're born and raised here. They go back to Egypt and visit, but they're true and true American.
Right.
So, it's our generation, the transitional immigrant, the one that actually immigrated. Mm-hmm. We're the generation that, we have the luxury of saying, you know what, I like that about your culture. I'm going to assimilate that. Right. And make that part of my identity. And this part of the culture, I don't really feel it. It's not my thing. So I'm just going to leave that alone. We'll leave that under the category of the others.
Well, if you're just joining us, this is True Talk on WMNF. I'm speaking to Bassem Hassan. He actually works at with the U.S. Census. That's not what we've been talking about so far. We've been just talking about what it means to be Egyptian-American, Arab-American, or Muslim-American, especially if you came here and immigrated at a young age. And, that feeling, where do you actually belong? Obviously, you and I chose to be American. We could have gone and lived in Egypt. We have that choice and still do. But for me, I choose to stay in the United States. I feel like it's the best place on earth, especially at this time. But doesn't mean it's perfect. There are obviously different challenges. And definitely, if you look at the political situation between the United States and Egypt, despite the problems that we have here, it's still far better off than what's happening in Egypt currently. But let's talk about the census now that you're involved in. Immigrant, and you're working at the census. Why are you doing it, and why is the census even important?
Well, it's funny, because the first part of our conversation actually really does tie into what I do with the census. When we say, MENA American audience.
And what does MENA stand for, by the way?
MENA is an acronym for Middle East North Africa. The way it's been executed, it tends to lean essentially into people who are Arabic speaking. But you know, this conversation about the sense of self and the sense of identity, this is actually part of the census. Let me start at the beginning and say, you know, the census is a constitutional mandate. It's actually written into the Constitution that every 10 years we do a head count of everybody who lives in the United States, including non-citizens. So the purpose of this is the data that's collected during the census helps determine things like congressional representation. How many congresspeople does your state get? And it helps to inform the distribution of funding. The federal government collects taxes, and that's money that's used towards programs that benefit your state. Or your county, or your town, your actual community, how do we know how much to allocate for these resources? And the number for this year is somewhere in the neighborhood of $675 billion per year.
Wow.
So that's every year for the next 10 years. So when we say things that are very, I mean, right now, things that are very tangible are healthcare facilities. Do they have the support, you know, with federal money to be able to provide adequate healthcare? It helps inform unemployment. It helps inform educational programs like STEM education in K-12. Pell Grants for colleges are funded by, informed by census data. So as your community grows, your need for resources grows, and this is the mechanism that allows the country to know where to allocate these resources.
And also, political districts or congressional districts are also decided by the census, right?
Yes, absolutely. Congressional representation. I mean, there was a couple of good examples of regions that really focused on getting out the count. Their populations had grown, and they actually picked up an additional candidate for Congress.
Right. Like in Florida, I think last time we picked up, you know, two or three additional candidates or congressional districts, whereas some states in the north or northeast lost seats because of the migration.
You can all, you know, being undercounted, you could lose representation and funding as well, because the government just follows the data, you know, which is why people like me exist. I'm a strategy director for the MENA demographic of the U.S. Census. It's considered a hard-to-count audience. So
you're trying to identify and encourage and make sure that the people, Americans of MENA background, Middle Eastern and North African backgrounds, or heritage or nationality, are counted in the census.
Yes, and that requires a lot of education and a lot of the right type of targeted advertising. You know, we have creative that's done in Arabic. We have Arabic digital radio, billboard, you know, stuff that you could download and print, PDFs that could be forwarded across mailing lists. You know, so it's, you know, the where we're at today, for me, started a couple of years ago, actually doing research with the census on understanding the community to learn what the needs are, where the barriers are, and try to devise a campaign that bypasses the barriers and addresses their needs. So it's funny that you mentioned earlier you chose to be here in America.
Yeah.
That was something that was almost verbatim stated in one of the focus groups that we held, when we had the conversation about, you know, what does it mean to you to be American? And I mean, it was literally almost word for word. The person said, I could have chosen anywhere in the world to emigrate to, but I chose to bring my family here. You know, and that's a, you know, that's a very
strong statement.
You know, that's a very powerful statement. You know, so it's funny because our conversation in the beginning really is, you know, the beginning parts of the research that we did into understanding the community.
Okay, so it's interesting. The U.S. Census has a strategist and a team that's making sure that this segment of the population is counted. Arab Americans, people from the Middle East and North African background. And by the way, if you were just joining us, I'm speaking to Bassem Hassan of the U.S. Census about the census and outreach to Arab and Muslim communities. Now, obviously, the census doesn't count religion, but they do count people of Arab and North African, Middle Eastern background. The question I have for you, despite having this team, there's no actual category in or actual race or national origin question or a category called MENA or Arab nationality on as one of the options.
Yes, that is correct.
And I remember there was a campaign, people, you know, count us, or, you know, it's like we want our own box to check. Because right now, somebody like an Egyptian American, like yourself or myself, what are they picking when they're checking that box on the census as far as their race or ethnicity?
So the instructions generally for everyone, but especially for our community, because of exactly this point of confusion, is check the box that you racially identify with. You could identify as white. You could also identify as black. You could identify as other. That's independent on you. The most important thing, though, is to write in the country of origin. So you could be, in this case, white or black Egyptian. But the important thing is to write in Egypt or Egyptian.
Yeah, so obviously they can't list every single country. You have to write it in.
Yes, and this helps MENA get credit for that count, that specific census count.
But I'm looking at the U.S. Census right now, and it's defining the different races. And where it says, you know, about, and it says white, its definition, the U.S. Census definition on their website, census.gov, says white, a person having origins in any of the original peoples of Europe, the Middle East, or North Africa. MENA, which is Middle East and North Africa, according to the definition by the census, says white.
You know, one of our partners...
First, is that true or not?
Well, it's, you know, it's self-identification is really up to the individual. You know, one of our partners is the Moorish Society of North America. And, you know, historically speaking, by Western standards, Moors are black.
Right.
You know, being Egyptian, you and I, we've seen the diversity of, you know,
the spectrum.
Yeah, the full spectrum. And that's been a challenge, actually, in my job, is that, you know, I spent a lot of time educating people I work with to understand that MENA is the most non-monolithic category you could possibly have. My father is, by Western standards, you know, could pass as a black man. He's got tight curls, you know, when he had hair. My mother on the other end of the spectrum, you know, she, you know, looks European Turkish, and but we're all purebred Cairo, going back to, you know, to Tutankhamun or something. And that's just one country.
Right.
You know, as we go across North Africa, as we go deep into the Saudi Peninsula, you know, the best instructions that really the community should embrace is you decide what you identify with racially, and the answer could be other.
yeah, that's a good workaround. I mean, you know, to get off that point, because that's been like whenever people think of census within our community, it's like, hey, they don't even recognize us. But what you're saying is whatever you identify with racially, you could be Black and Egyptian. You could be white and Egyptian.
Yes, absolutely.
Obviously, most it's less likely you're going to be Asian and Egyptian, you know, unless somehow, you know, you're mixed.
It might be a mix. It's possible, but you know, just the Black and the white alone, you know, and it's, you know, and I think that's a construct. You know, when we get into Western society, you know, we try to place things in neatly into these categories,
specifically, you know, race, and a lot of it has to do with the history of the United States and the whole issue of race and, you know, race conflict, you know, in the past and what people have gone through. So they always want to identify. I mean, I know some. You know, some Muslims that came from Sudan, for example.
Yeah, absolutely.
Said, you know, they didn't, you know, they said, like, I heard this from a scholar. He says, I didn't recognize or realize I was Black until I came to America. Like it wasn't an issue for him back then. It was just, okay, that's my skin color. But it wasn't, like, so racialized until he came to the United States. And then, you know, because of the experiences that have happened here through slavery, why, you know, it became so important, and he realized how important it is.
And that's a very common experience. You know, and that's one of the things that when we say men in the United States, we're also including people who just arrived here a few months ago.
Yeah, so I mean, that's a challenge. People that just arrived a few months ago, many of them are refugees escaping oppressive regimes or very difficult situations or war. And now you're coming to them and saying, hey, the government wants to count you. You know, they're going to be a little afraid, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. That was one of the conversations that happened when we were conducting focus groups, was the term census in their countries of origin don't mean the same thing as it means here. You know, there was one person that made a comment that, the moment the government wants to count you, it's time to leave, because usually something bad happens after that.
Right.
You know, yeah, so that guided the educational process that we had to develop. You know, so, you know, people are not necessarily coming in from no knowledge of what census is. They're coming in with incorrect knowledge of what the U.S. census does.
And a lot of it is, it could be fear-based, especially under the current, I guess, political rhetoric that exists out there, where it's anti-immigrant, and then people may be reluctant, like, hey, do I want them to know where I live? You know, do I want them to know? So how are you overcoming these things, or this fear that exists within the society, especially with people that are speaking different languages? They're not, you know, necessarily speaking English, they're whatever their native language may be. And most of the time in your situation, or the community, the migrant community you're trying to reach out to, or new migrant community, they, you know, their language is Arabic.
Well, we went with a two-pronged approach. We have a lot of creative assets that we developed. They're developed in language. They utilize actual many people who are known in the community. We didn't hire for the spot that we did the commercial. We hired an actual family. Mm-hmm. They were not actors and actresses. And this is people from the community, from New York. You know, everybody was like, oh, like, I know you, you live around the corner. We put into the actual creative itself a lot of emphasis on Title 13, which is the legal protections that we're bound by as census employees, and the, you know, overwhelming consequences that happen if we were to illegally release data identifiable information, which is the essence of what people are afraid of. I don't want my name on a list. You know, so we're, you know, teaching them that the information we're collecting is to produce statistics, and nobody outside of census legally can see the stuff. The second prong is we work with community leaders and organizations, and have them help us get out the message. So we have many prominent secular and religious organizations that we've partnered with, ISNA, ICNA, the Coptic Church of North America. We have prominent individuals. We refer to them as influencers that we've worked with to help us gain the trust of the community. So, you know, essentially, if the message is coming from the Arab American Institute or the Islamic Society of North America, you can feel a little at ease that it's been vetted, as opposed to here's a flashy commercial that pops up on TV or
with a bunch of, you know, like white people that they're not familiar with, like, hey, come register.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, we did strive for authenticity, you know, so everybody really genuinely is Arab. But like, I mean, at the end of the day, unless you know me personally, I'm a stranger and I'm telling you to do something that you're a little uncomfortable to do because you don't really know.
And you haven't done it before. And it's like, you know, it happens every 10 years. So it's not like happens yearly.
Yeah, exactly. So the partnership program, that prong of census activity, is really critical in gaining the trust of the community. You know, it's, you know, we have you know, several religious leaders and secular influencers. They've written op-ed pieces. They've done video spots for us. The executive director from Islamic Relief was at an interfaith event that we did, and we have a really nice video spot that we made with him, you know, talking about the census and talking about the benefits. You know, right. So that gives you a little more confidence.
And
that
you're doing radio shows like ours where, you know, it's reaching out to that segment as well.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this really truly is the heart of the campaign.
Right.
You know, it's, the personal, you know, touch that you can't recreate in, you know, a print ad.
Guys, we're talking to Bassem Hassan from the U.S. Census about making sure everybody's counted. And for his task, he's specifically working on a strategy to make sure people of Middle Eastern and North African background in the United States are also counted. Do you have to be a citizen to be counted, or does this include U.S. residents, or can it also include people on visas?
As long as you are currently residing in the U.S., there is no question on the census of whether or not you are a citizen.
Were there attempts earlier to try to put that on the census, and it was not done, right?
Yes, there was an attempt by the current administration to have it added. And I believe it got bogged down in the Supreme Court. And the end of the day, the Supreme Court said, you know, it's not happening. Let's continue with the census normally.
Okay, so now normally counting people, that many people, million, you know, hundreds of millions of Americans, is no easy task. But now it's under this pandemic, and, you know, at the heart or, at the, you know, the prime of your campaign, this critical time, people are now locked down and, you know, the social distancing is happening. So how has that been a challenge to the U.S. Census and to your work specifically?
Well, it has been a challenge, no question about it. We've been very nimble in you know, creating new assets, doubling down on our partnerships. The one thing that's actually been very helpful is this year you have the opportunity to do the census online. So the you have a online by phone or by mail. There's no real reason to wait for an enumerator to come knock on your door. And it was the field force, the enumerators, that were put on hold for a little while because of the
they can't go out. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, hey, if you've got nothing else to do, take 10 minutes. Go online and finish your census.
So how do they do that? You go to census.gov?
2020census.gov. And if you had received your paper one, there should be a code on there. You can enter the code and just complete it online. And if you don't have a code, there's another button that you press, which will still allow you to complete it online.
Now, when is the deadline to actually finish the census by? Is there a deadline?
That's a tough question because it was extended.
Okay.
I would like to say that the expectation is that the count is completed by middle of October. I believe October 15th. But if you haven't, if you're into October and you haven't done it, I would expect by then somebody's knocking on your door. You know,
so
you'd have an enumerator coming to motivate you.
So this is all obviously tracked. Now, how many Americans are there now, approximately?
Rough estimate, 350 million.
350 million. Now, the last census was done by 2010, and at that time they said it was about 304 million Americans. What percentage of that came from the MENA region or the Arab background or ancestry?
So the data that I heard for the 2010 census estimated it at, I believe, 10 million. It was either 10 million, I want to say, or it could have been 1.5.
Actually, let me look it up. I had a tab open. Yeah, you're right. It's 1.5 million.
Yeah, it's 1.5. And that was, okay, so that's where the 10 is actually my opinion.
Oh, okay.
So it was 1.5 million was actually counted.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty sure I've been to weddings that were bigger than that.
No, looking at, you know, and that's the problem, getting these people to actually, register. Now, what's the number one population as far as ancestry of which country? You know, the largest population.
Oh, you mean like, what's the biggest country of origin for MENA?
Yeah, for MENA.
Well, generally, our density comes from the Sham region of the Middle East. So in the United States, we have a humongous Egyptian, Lebanese, Syrian representation.
Yeah, so I'm looking at the census here. It says Lebanese is the top number from the U.S. Census in 2010, which was about 485,000 people. Again, it seems like there's a lot more. And then number two is Egyptian, number three is Syrian, then followed by Palestinian, Morocco, Iraq, Jordan, and Yemen. Now, I was looking at also some interesting numbers on this from 2010. When it comes to average size of household size by selected Arab ancestry. Now, the national average in 2010 was 2.59. The total or average Arab household is 2.93. So it's a little bigger than the average, overall. But surprisingly, out of all the Arab ancestry countries, the largest household goes to the Yemenis at 4.34. It's like almost double. Yeah.
So those would be households that have generations.
I guess. The same household. And then also followed by Palestinians, Jordanians, Iraqi, Egyptian. So all those came before the Egyptians. Syrian and Lebanese are, you know, at the end as far as household size.
Now, keep in mind, too, Syrian and Lebanese,
been here longer.
They're the most assimilated out of the regions. They've been here for, in some regions, over 100 years.
Correct.
You know, yeah. So they should more closely align with what a the traditional American household statistic would look like.
Yeah, because they're not. They've been here for 100 years or almost 100 years.
Yeah, we did a focus group with their community over in Illinois, and I mean, you easily 8th, 9th generation.
Wow. Home ownership. I'm giving a lot of factoids here to our listeners. Home ownership. The national home ownership rate nationally is 66.6%, compared to the Arab community, 59.6%. However, the Lebanese and Syrians are above the national average at 71% and 69%. So the rest of the Arab, again, it goes to your point that because of this generational, you know, being here longer, they've been able to assimilate more and amass more wealth, which, you know, they're able to, I guess, have more home ownership, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I mean, that pattern is exactly correct. You know, it's when you look at home ownership, generational wealth really contributes to, you know, the ability to own a home. So it's not just that, for instance, Arabs tend to have more professional occupations, higher income, you know, but you also got to look at, you know, a family whose legacy is eight generations long, you know, passing assets from one generation to the next, you know, it really does facilitate, you know, home ownership and multiple home ownerships as well. And that's, you know, as compared to the family that has literally mom and dad just got here in the 70s.
Wow. Okay. Well, what else should we need to know about the census that we haven't touched on?
It is critical for MENA to be part of the American story. This is a way that I've been packaging it for our community, you know, is that when you look at the snapshot of census data, you know, every 10 years, it becomes, you know, a slide in a video. And when you, like, you take all of the slides and you flip them, you know, it creates a movie. If we're not counted, we're not present in the story, you know, the history of America.
We're absent.
No, we are here.
Mm.
So, you know, it is very important, you know, for every household to be counted and everyone in the household to be counted. You know, me personally, I was shocked when I read the original statistic of 1.5 million.
Yes, yeah, seems like so undercounted.
Exactly. You know, especially being from a region, you know, I'm from Jersey. I've been to Dearborn. I've been to Orange County, LA, you know, and I'm like, really? 1.5 million? That's it? I don't buy it. Yeah. But if we're not being counted, then that's, you know, these are the numbers we end up with. We become.
Well, what about when they get counted and they're afraid to actually say that their original, you know, national identity or their, you know, country of origin or their background? Well, maybe they're just putting something else or leaving it blank.
Yeah, and they could be, absolutely. I understand the fear, but I can't reinforce enough that the laws that are in place currently are really boilerplate. You know, we're all of us employees, we're sworn, you know, to secrecy. The penalties are, I believe, like $250,000 fine, 6 years in prison.
Wow.
I mean, they're significant penalties. And that's to protect the integrity of the data. You know, so I do understand that I've been through it like everybody else. You know, I've been here since literally the 70s. I get it, but that can't be, you know, that's not a good enough reason for us to remain in the shadows and be invisible. It's, you know, we will have a healthier and stronger community when it's represented accurately.
I'm speaking with Bassem Hassan from the United States Census Bureau, and we're speaking about the census, 2020 census, and the challenges he's facing in registering Arab Americans and people from the MENA region, which stands for Middle East and North Africa, in the census this time around. And according to the 2010 census, it said there's like 1.5 million Arab ancestry folks, households out there, or individuals, which seems like way undercounted. I wonder how much of, you know, things like 9/11 played into that type of fear that people don't want to identify because, you know, the stigma and the hatred that was happening, and to this day it's still out there. But it also reminds me that, you know, something that you just mentioned, that, you know, to be part of the American story, you know, many people seem like they discovered Islam and Muslims and Arabs like when 9/11 happened, when these families and people have been here and part of the fabric of America for generations, you know, contributing to society. But then Americans and, you know, in general, were introduced to this segment of the population by a horrific event. And now everybody's like, well, where did these people come from? So I think it goes to your point that the Arab and Muslim community haven't been part of the American story as much, you know, and they're not necessarily included. And maybe part of it is because they're not being counted in the census. And a lot of that could be because they're not declaring who they are.
Yeah. And like I said, I do understand, you know, the fear factor, you know, but it's been literally a full generation since 9/11.
And right. There are people being born today and they weren't here when 9/11 happened.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was just going to mention, you know, it's, you know, like the comment you made, I'm choosing to be American. You know, my parents chose, out of all the countries they could have emigrated to, they chose the United States. My children are born, they're being raised in this country. If I don't vote, I don't have a voice. If I am not counted, I don't have the opportunity for proper representation in Congress. And my immediate community where I live is going to be deprived of resources. So there's a certain point
like healthcare and assistance and even language. If they don't know so many people speak these different languages in the community, then they don't offer services.
Exactly. And, you know, and it's the services that, you know, the haves and the have nots. You know, when we look at the, you know, the districts that everybody really wants to live in, you know, they have tremendous services. It's, you know, it's they don't just have McMansions. They have, you know, they have things that give their family and their children opportunities, and that give them security, and that give them comfort. And these are things that are funded by the census, you know, even things we don't think about, like infrastructure, you know, the quality of your mass transit or your road system, you know. So if, you know, if we choose to continue to live in the shadows, then we can't complain. Because the opportunity is here now to, and sincerely, we're, you know, MENA is invited wholeheartedly. You know, if, let's put it this way, if the census didn't take it seriously, my job wouldn't exist. It wouldn't be a priority.
Right.
But it is a priority, and it's that way, you know, for the right reason. So it's our opportunity to own it. And say, if we want the things that we talk about, we have to get up and vote. And we have to be counted in the census. Because this is how the constitutional processes work in this country. You know, so it's, you know, the benefit far exceeds the risk.
Yeah, and I think you're right. This the importance of the census is critical. And to be counted. And I think the not being counted actually causes a lot more harm than any benefit that you may think that you, or perceived protections that you may think that you have. Because again, there is power in numbers. And if people continue to think that you're only 1.5 million out of 350 million people, then, you know, that's not going to, you know, then even politicians themselves, when they look at the numbers and say, well, should I care about this community? How much damage can this community do? And then they look at it and it's only 1.5 compared to, you know, let's say, you know, 5 million or 10 million or 15 million. Then they may consider like, okay, well, I need to consider the, you know, the perspectives of these individuals as well.
And also look at it at a community level. You know, so our Arab communities, you know, they're densely populated. You know, I can think of several of them just in the New Jersey, New York, you know, region. Are they really being funded adequately? You know, do they have the full capacity of, you know, the resource allocation for their healthcare?
No.
You know, are there students?
A lot of times,
the schools of the students being funded.
No.
You know, the full capacity.
Right.
You know, and the, you know, this is the consequences of not participating.
Right.
You know, and it's just, you know, it takes a few minutes. You know, you can do it in Arabic. That's an option.
That I did not even know.
Yeah, you can, if you call online, there's a whole section of the census website with literature in Arabic that will guide you through it. You know, it's every opportunity has been made to facilitate the participation of MENA individuals. You know, if you could call the census and they'll transfer you to somebody who can assist you.
But it can also be done online. I mean, I think the online method is the fastest and, you know, easy. It can be done at any time of the day, and they can do that by going to 2020census.gov, correct?
Yes. Yeah. It's, you know, and every, you know, every slice of the demographic has been taken into consideration. You know, someone like me, I'll do it online from my phone while I'm on the couch. You know, but you got, you know, Ammo and Tunt, you know, they might need somebody on the phone to help them with it.
Ammo is uncle in Arabic, and the Tunt is like aunt, but only Egyptians use that.
Yes.
I don't know. I think the others will say like,
Khaltu or something.
Khaltu, Khalti, or Ammiti.
Yeah.
Even,
yeah,
you know, aunt and uncle in Arabic is like gender specific, so it's not the same word for the woman and, you know, my uncle and my aunt. I guess, is it the... No, it's not only uncle and aunt, it's for both, like whether they're my mother's side or father's side.
Yeah, your mother's side or your father's side.
So you actually have four different words for uncle and aunts.
I always default to tunt for, you know, all women. It's just like that's like me saying ma'am.
It's like a catch-all. But then yeah, people, some tunts get offended.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
You call them tunt. You call them auntie. And, like, you know, they're only 10 years older than you. That's fine.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. I used to get yelled at all the time.
Just say, like, come to me, Niala Yani, you know.
You know, but like, you know, kidding aside, there is a part of, you know, a segment of the audience that's just, they're simply older and they're not as comfortable using technology, but they're going to do great on the phone.
Right. Okay, we're about to wrap it up. So last word of advice, go out and do your census, make sure you're counted. Anything else, Bassem?
You know, it's considering the circumstances, you know, please stay safe. And you know, it's the census, if you haven't done it, only takes a few minutes, and the impact of those few minutes is the next 10 years.
Wow, that's big. And who knows what will be happening 10 years from now. Thank you so much, Bassem Hassan from the United States Census Bureau, for joining us on True Talk.
Oh, thank you. I really do appreciate the opportunity. And, you know, it's inshallah, we have an opportunity to chat again sometime.
Okay, we will. I'm going to close out the show, and you have a good weekend. That was Bassem Hassan from the United States Census Bureau joining us. It's really important to be counted. And despite what some people in the community may be feeling, that there's somehow some repercussions, there aren't. Just do it. Get counted. You can do it online. Do it via the phone. Go to 2020census.gov to do that. Stay safe, even though the governor is opening up or has opened up some of the different businesses slowly. Stay safe. Continue to wear those masks. Do the social distancing. If you can, if you can afford it and don't have to be outside, don't go outside. Stay at home until the numbers continue to go down. And together we'll get through this, inshallah. Ramadan Mubarak for all our Muslims, brothers and sisters out there are fasting. We're doing the show as we're fasting right now. And we'll see you here next Friday, same time, same place. This is True Talk on WMNF, WMNF Tampa. NPR News is next. And after that, it's Rob or Laura. Have a great weekend. Enjoy.